Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Sandra Day O'Connor, the first woman ever appointed to the U.S. Supreme Court, is stepping down from the bench. The 75-year-old O'Connor has been a key moderate swing vote on issues such as abortion and the death penalty since she was appointed to the bench by Ronald Reagan in 1981. This morning, President Bush praised Justice O'Connor for her contributions.
This great lady, born in El Paso, Texas, rose above the obstacles of an earlier time and became one of the most admired Americans of our time. She leaves an outstanding record of service to the United States, and our nation is deeply grateful.
The president also sent a message to the Senate, where recent judicial nominations were stymied by filibusters.
The nation also deserves a dignified process of confirmation in the United States Senate, characterized by fair treatment, a fair hearing, and a fair vote.
Well, joining us on the line now, Jonathan Turley, George Washington University law professor. And Jonathan, court watchers, of course, had been expecting the resignation of Chief Justice William Rehnquist, who's been battling thyroid cancer. So are you surprised?
Well, not really, in the sense that O'Connor has been grouped with three other justices as the most likely to resign for the last 4 or 5 years. She is one of the older justices, and also she no longer had the likely prospect of being Chief Justice. What is a surprise is that we got so little forewarning about it. There have been rumors in the last 2 weeks that O'Connor may indeed be resigning. But, you know, we've had those rumors for the last 5 years.
Right. Well, what do you think her retirement means to the court?
Well, for the court, it could not be more significant, and it could not be more significant for the president. I think President George Bush just got the legacy that he's been looking for.
In that?
Well, you know, if he were to replace William Rehnquist, it would create some likely changes, but they would be marginal. He would be replaced by another conservative. Sandra Day O'Connor is the swing vote in a host of areas, from abortion to discrimination to affirmative action to environmental laws. She's that vote in the 5-4 decisions that often went against the right wing of the court. For conservatives, this is an incredible opportunity. If they were to replace one member, many conservatives would pick Sandra Day O'Connor. She is despised by many conservatives because they view her as something of a turncoat in critical areas. I'm also a bit surprised she's retiring this term, because this has not been a good term for her. She's actually been on the losing side of a number of cases. Kennedy, Justice Kennedy, has emerged as a swing voter in critical cases, including cases involving the Ten Commandments. But for President Bush, this is really what he campaigned on. He now has the opportunity to replace the ultimate swing vote on the court with a consistent conservative.
And who are some of the names floating around?
Well, the shortlist judges include some that are actually to the right of most of the conservatives on the court. I mean, this includes judges who even William Rehnquist voted against as having too extreme in terms of positions. The leading contenders have some characteristics in common. The White House would like, I believe, a baby boomer. You know, they want as young as possible, you know, short of an embryonic stem cell, to put on that court.
And that, you know, they would consider someone like Alberto Gonzalez, who's now the U.S. Attorney General, to be young.
Well, that's right. Gonzalez is sort of a trifecta. He's young, he's got a Texas connection, and most importantly, he's Hispanic. That creates a double legacy. You have the legacy of a young appointment that'll be there for many decades, and the first Hispanic, which could not be more important to Republicans. The problem with Alberto Gonzalez is that he was marred in the torture scandal. He signed the infamous memo that seemed to condone torture. For conservatives, he is not a trusted conservative. They want someone who is going to be ideologically pure. Gonzalez really is not that for most conservatives.
Well, you also mentioned federal courts of appeals judges. They include J. Michael Luttig, John Roberts, some of the names floating around. There's also been mention of former Solicitor General Theodore Olson, whose wife died on 9/11.
Well, Ted Olson, I think, is an unlikely choice because of his age. You know, this is a White House who knows the advantage of appointing young individuals. If they were to appoint someone like Gonzalez or Luttig or some of the other conservatives, they would be putting someone in their 50s on the court. That person could stay on the court for three decades.
Well, Jonathan Turley, what do you think the possibility is that President Bush will name a replacement for Justice O'Connor soon?
I think it would be a mistake for him to immediately announce a replacement. It is much better to keep your nominee in your pocket until you're ready to move him in the Senate. Otherwise, they just twist in the powerful winds of the Beltway, and that's never good.
And, of course, there's now the possibility that there will be two openings on the Supreme Court if Supreme Court Justice Rehnquist also retires.
That's correct. And I think that President Bush is now in a position to have the greatest influence of any prior American president on the legal landscape. He could very well change the Supreme Court dramatically and thereby change a host of areas that are currently held by a single vote. And that vote is more often than not Sandra Day O'Connor's.
As we said, Jonathan, much more on this topic throughout the day and throughout the weekend, and I'm sure throughout the summer. Jonathan Turley, George Washington University law professor, thanks very much.
Okay.
Well, this week, Congress convened a full committee hearing on the next pandemic flu and U.S. readiness. Health officials have been warning about a possible new worldwide epidemic since a strain of avian flu, known as H5N1, surfaced in Asia in 1997. Regarding readiness, one leading expert writes that the U.S. lacks sufficient funds and the world has no health infrastructure to handle the subsequent disease, social disruption, and panic. That expert is Lori Garrett of the Council on Foreign Relations. She writes about pandemic in this month's issue of Foreign Affairs and joins us on the line. Lori, chilling writing, why the concern now?
There are many bird flus out there, but there's one particular one that we're very, very concerned about. Now, this H5N1 stands for hemagglutinin type 5 and neuraminidase type 1. Those are the two things that your immune system recognizes and makes antibodies against. And your body would say, I've seen this before. I might get a little bit sick, but I'm going to muster a nice, strong immune response and destroy the virus, and I won't die. Hmm. Well, the problem is that H5N1, as a type of flu, has never in known history infected human beings before, which means that neither you nor anybody listening to this program is naturally immune to it.
Right. And so far, when this H5N1, or as we have called it, avian flu, has reached humans through birds, it has killed half the people that it's reached, which makes it particularly virulent.
Yes, actually, just a little over half, about 55%. That's far beyond any normal flu season death rate, and far beyond the worst flu we know of, which was 1918, when somewhere between 50 and 100 million people died of flu before the age of commercial jet travel. And that one only had a virulence of less than 3%.
Hmm. What else is it about this H5N1 that's raising so many concerns?
Well, there are quite a lot of things that are worrisome. First of all, when it gets into chickens, the kill rate isn't 55%, it's 100%. Hmm. Now that is astounding. The second thing is that despite lots and lots of attempts to control it since it first appeared in 1997 by killing off chickens that are not yet infected and sort of like creating fire breaks for a forest fire, it has just continued and continued to spread and now can be found in a huge range of different bird species, including migratory birds that travel more than 1,000 miles in their migratory path. Mm. The other problem is that when it has gotten into people and produced death in more than half of them, we don't really fully understand how it gets from birds to people. And that makes us very worried because there are some indications that in at least three clusters of cases, there was human-to-human transmission. What we know is that flu always starts out as a bird flu. It's just that usually it goes from birds, wild birds, to domestic birds, and then from domestic birds to other farm animals on the same farms in China, typically to pigs. And once it gets into pigs, it takes on a mutational form that is perfect for mammals. And then you get human-to-human transmission. the problem we're seeing here is that it's jumping straight to humans from birds, bypassing this whole intermediary step of going through pigs or other mammals. And we don't understand how it is doing that. We also don't know what genetic change is necessary in the virus to make it a rapid human-to-human transmitter. And we have no way of predicting whether it will make that jump anytime soon, and if it does, how much virulence it may sacrifice in order to become highly transmissible. We're just looking at a huge black box here.
Right. And yet, you have to look. People have been setting up models. Can you give us a sense of what some of those models show might be the outcome if this disease does mutate that way?
Oh, boy. You know, one thing is clear. The death toll would be enormous. And it would spread globally very, very rapidly. I mean, now in the age of jet travel and globalized economics and so on, we could pretty much predict this thing would be all over the world in a matter of days, whereas in 1918 it was all over the world in a matter of months.
Huh.
We also know that it's so contagious that all the sorts of things that politicians and leaders are likely to order done to slow it won't work, primarily quarantine, shutting down borders, things like that. Those sorts of measures would be incredibly costly to the global economy and to civil liberties, but are very unlikely to slow the virus.
I want to talk more about some of the other kinds of costs, but I have to just stop you there, Lori. In a couple of days, this would spread around the world? I mean, I know we live in an age of jet travel and all of that, but that's astonishing.
Yes, well, flu is spread through so many different means. I know that most people think it's coughing. Well, that is one way, but actually, the flu virus is very, very hardy, and it survives on environmental surfaces for a great deal of time, as long as nearly a week, on doorknobs and towels and all sorts of commonly held surfaces. And then, of course, it's easily spread through ventilation systems. Everybody knows what it's like to travel in the winter on an airplane and come home with the flu.
Well, and the WHO put out a report estimating that 8 million people might be killed worldwide, but they retracted that because they said it's going to be a far higher number.
Yes, they were severely criticized for that lowball estimate. I don't think there's anybody who would accept such a low figure in the general public health world.
And you've also written that an Oxford University computer model, assuming that the virus had a low virulence, put global economic losses at $2 to $3 trillion.
Well, all you have to do is think, how many people in the airlines unions would be willing to fly?
Hmm.
Now you've grounded all the airlines. Would cargo transmitters be willing to go? Well, I could pretty much guarantee you most of the dock workers would refuse. And why would somebody willingly fly for FedEx or UPS or any of the big carriers? Not only that, inventory systems are based on the assumption that things sell and turn over in a matter of 24 to 48 hours. So in an extremely short amount of time, the shelves would be bare.
That's Lori Garrett of the Council on Foreign Relations. When we come back, what should be done? Can anything be done about a possible new pandemic? And if you've just joined us, our top story today, Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor is resigning. We'll have more in our newscast at the half hour. You're listening to Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we've been talking to health expert Lori Garrett, author of The Coming Plague, as Congress considers the possibility of a new catastrophic flu pandemic. Lori, you write that the world's governments are woefully underprepared for such a pandemic, so what should be done?
Well, there are many tiers of answers to that. If this mutation happens in time for the upcoming flu season, and flu season here for us usually starts in late September, there is very little we can do. We are in real trouble. And we, as everybody, rich and poor, America to Swaziland, we're all in deep trouble. There's a lot we could have been doing if we'd been listening to the scientific community, if the policymakers had been paying attention and taking seriously the warnings from the scientific community.
What could they have done?
One of our biggest problems is vaccine production. And I'm sure all the listeners recall what we went through last year when the major manufacturer we were counting on had a decertified production center, mm-hmm. and we all of a sudden were going around all over the world begging other countries to share vaccine with us. By January or February, when the season of flu was basically over with, we finally had our target amount of vaccine. That target was actually overly small target if we were talking about a pandemic flu. Let me deconstruct this a little bit. The first step is you need vaccine. Well, to rapidly produce vaccine is almost impossible with flu because the way we make flu vaccine, unlike other vaccines, is we have to grow the virus on chicken eggs, and those chicken eggs have to be maintained in sterile conditions. And then we take the antigens off the chicken eggs and from them make the vaccine. That is a rate-limiting step that cannot possibly be overstated. The maximum possible production is somewhere around 300 million to 400 million doses for the entire world of 6-point-something billion people. So even in a best-case scenario with current technology, 90% of the planet goes unvaccinated. Vaccines are not profitable on a scale that the pharmaceutical industry is accustomed to profit. And therefore, the number of manufacturers on the playing field has shrunk from several dozen 40 years ago to basically three or four in the whole world today.
Would you recommend the government charging the pharmaceutical companies with doing this?
Well, we don't have the legal power to do that.
Right.
Now, there are have always been discussions of various legal mechanisms that might make it possible for the government to create incentives for the pharmaceutical industry to get back in the game, but none of those have ever been passed, and even if they were passed now, they wouldn't be able to take effect significantly in any short term. The second problem is that there's a lot of research going on to try and come up with alternative forms of flu vaccine, and some of those may pan out, but they're not going to pan out in a year, 2 years, 3 years. Again, that's a long-term issue. The fourth problem is that we have a drug that is partially effective in lowering the likelihood of you dying. And the drug is called Tamiflu, but there's three crucial difficulties with Tamiflu. The first is that it must be taken within the first 36 hours of infection to have any efficacy at all. So if you don't have health insurance or if you live in a country with a bad healthcare system, you're not going to get that drug. So forget it, you're going to die. The second problem with it is it's made by only one manufacturer who holds the patent, Roche Pharmaceuticals. Roche has devoted only one production site to it in Switzerland, and their production scale is very, very low. And then the final problem is that some of the viruses out there are already resistant to Tamiflu, and therefore it's not even effective if taken properly. And there are some indications that the H5N1 may be up to 50% resistant to it, in which case you're really walking a fine line about whether or not it's even worth it to stockpile the drug.
Lori Garrett, Senior Fellow for Global Health of the Council on Foreign Relations. She's also the author of The Coming Plague. She's talking to us about the possibility of pandemic. More and more healthcare officials are worried about it in light of the virulence of the one avian flu we've been talking about. Lori, we also know that, as you write, the World Health Organization passed two resolutions to create a worldwide infrastructure to have surveillance labs and monitoring and response processes, that whole part of the equation, but there's no money for it. As Congress meets to talk about, you know, the possibility of a flu pandemic, what's the one thing you would want to tell them that can be done?
I think that there has to be a radically revved up diplomatic pressure put on key Asian countries. Our State Department, Condoleezza Rice, should be on a plane right now flying to Vietnam, to Cambodia, to Laos, to China, to Hong Kong, to Taiwan, to say to these countries, your people are going to be the first to die. You have the primary responsibility to the global community. We have got to have rapid identification of any human beings who have the flu in your regions. We've got to be able to swoop in and get immediate laboratory stuff. Our only hope for stopping a global pandemic is to stop it at source. But right now, the lag time between the identification of human cases in Vietnam and their official confirmation and reporting to the World Health Organization is 8 weeks. Well, by 8 weeks, if it's a highly contagious form, it will have already spread all over Asia at the very least, if not all over the world. There's a desperate, desperate need to say to these countries, look, please let us provide you with assistance. Please let us come in, look at your labs, and help build them up rapidly right now. To some degree, each of these countries have accepted a little help, but by no means have they created an infrastructure out at the village level that would help speed up the identification of flu cases. And we just can't afford, as a global community, to wait for Vietnam to come out of underdevelopment into an advanced, developed society with an appropriate healthcare infrastructure.
Lori Garrett has written terrifically about the possibility of a new flu pandemic. We'll link to her article in this month's Foreign Affairs Journal. Lori, we're going to let you go, but Lori, I just want to ask you, what do you say to the people who say that you are Chicken Little?
No, I hope I am. I hope I'm dead wrong. And I would love to have a situation where 3 years from now, after we've gone through three flu seasons with no great catastrophic event, your listeners could call up and say that I was a jerk. I would love that, and I hope it happens.
Lori Garrett of the Council on Foreign Relations, also author of The Coming Plague. For more, go to our website, here-now.org. Well, that was cheery. Stay with us. Much more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. A former teacher has been convicted of assaulting a student at an internationally recognized school for autistic children. The Boston Higashi School draws kids from around the world because of its success rate with unorthodox and physical methods developed in Japan. They include a regimented daily schedule, vigorous exercise, no medication, and, if needed, what the school calls physical prompts, such as holding children's arms to their sides. But the parents of the student claim their son was dragged across the floor and abused in other ways at the school. Well, attorney Mike Grace is representing Boston Higashi School in the case. Mike, this former teacher, Mr. Nishimura, has been convicted of assaulting Scott Tedeman, an 18-year-old student at Boston Higashi School, 5 years ago. So what did the judge find?
The judge found that on three occasions, Mr. Nishimura bent his fingers back twice and dragged him across the floor. And the star witness for the government testified that in those three occasions, he didn't observe any injury to Scott.
Well, it raises the question, as you well know. Was Mr. Nishimura following the school protocol, or was this something he did on his own? Which is bad behavior on the teacher's part, and which was school policy?
Oh, definitely not school policy. It's contrary to school policy, and the star witness for the government never intervened and never reported it to anybody at the school.
As you know, there have been complaints about the school since it was founded. At one point, the state had to appoint a monitor for a year because some students, according to the state, had some unexplained injuries. What is the policy of the school as far as treating students? Why is it so physical?
When a lot of parties talk about the school, they have a studied ignorance of the nature of the students. They're autistic. Many of them are difficult, aggressive, violent, self-injurious. Injuries are going to happen with no wrongdoing. And there have been, I think, about 360 students during the history of the school and over 1,000 staff. As we all know, no school, no person, no institution, no parent is perfect. The allegations in this underlying lawsuit focus on one school year, 99-2000, and Scott was at the school for 14 years, including for 9 months after the alleged incidents in the summer of 2000. And three staff, three comparatively inexperienced Japanese staff, who long ago left the school. It's a very good school, and it welcomes scrutiny by anybody. And if you took a poll of the parents, I think you'd get virtually uniform praise.
Mike Grays is representing the Boston Higashi School in a civil lawsuit that's been brought by a former student. Mike, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, let's turn to a parent. Lisa Burgess is the mother of a child enrolled at the Boston Higashi School. She's also vice president of the school's Parents Association, and she joins us on the line. Lisa, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And could you tell us more about this Japanese method, the Higashi method? What exactly is the method?
Daily life therapy actually encompasses the child's whole being. When the child gets up in the morning to the time the child goes to sleep, they address all the daily living skills that a child needs, and behavior modification is incorporated into every task.
Well, how physical is it?
Well, the physical part of daily life therapy, it's a little misunderstood. Autistic children tend to be very active and tend to have a lot of energy. and the kids jog in the morning before class. And what they find, and Harvard's done studies on this as well, when they do jogging, they do exercise, their body calms down. They calm down. They actually attend much better.
We understand that the physical activities helps vent some of these intense feelings that autistic children have and can't express.
Yes, but it's also very good in the students at the school. They learn gymnastics. They learn to do a thing called a balance disc. They learn all kinds of skills that help them actually integrate into society. And they also learn to accomplish something. When they accomplish a goal in gym class, that carries over to the classroom and gives them confidence.
But as you all know, Lisa, there have been a lot of questions about this method at this school. At one point, as I said earlier, the state had to appoint a monitor because there seemed to be unexplained injuries, surveillance cameras photographing instructors pulling someone's hair, these allegations of rug burns, students pulled across the rug. Is there a certain kind of physicality between the teacher and the students that you as a parent endorse?
No, it's actually not a physical program in that sense. There were several isolated incidences, and the school was very open with the parents, actually, about this.
So you think they were just isolated incidents?
Yes, and the enrollment's actually gone up since, the isolated incidents. Parents have come to investigate the school, have fallen in love with the school, and there's actually two parents that have fought legally to get into the school.
What is it about the school that, as a parent, you appreciate?
This has given Dakota his life. And it's given him his life back. At 5 years old, Dakota had three words, was a very aggressive child, and having a medically involved child in the home, we were very afraid for that child's safety.
Because again, remind us, autistic children...
Well, it's such a broad spectrum, right. But for ourselves, Dakota was a child that could be very, very physical. You had to watch him every second. He would run off into the woods. You couldn't take your eye off him for a minute. In fact, at Higashi, the teachers endure quite a bit. All staff that work with autistic children run the risk of being bitten, kicked, slapped, headbutted at any given moment.
So
and
I guess
it's very hard to predict.
I guess I'm wondering, there must be some endorsement of some kind of physical interaction between a teacher and an autistic child. I would imagine there would have to be, because you know what they might confront.
Well, what Higashi does is they teach the children postures and poses, basically attention, sit down and make a pose, or sit down and hold your knees. And what they find is when a child starts to, you know, quote-unquote, lose it and have trouble calming down or getting together, once they learn these postures, they can actually, like my son will get tense at the grocery store, and something that would have sent him kicking and screaming and I would have been literally holding on to him for dear life, now I can say make a pose, and he just... puts his hands behind his back, and he kind of does some deep breathing, and he focuses on that instead of what's making him anxious, and it actually helps him work through it.
To many parents of autistic children, that would be a miracle.
There's a lot of miracles that happen there.
Well, I was going to say, what would you say to the parents, though, who are critical, who say the teachers are overly harsh, that there have been bruises, trips to emergency rooms? I mean, what would you say to that?
Well, children get hurt. Children get hurt in any school. These children are very physical, and a lot of times they're self-injurious children. They hurt themselves, and I think if you look at any program in the autistic population, this is not unusual, and I think at Higashi, the children, as they get older, learn to control themselves much better. It's much, much less. I spend a lot of time at the school. I've actually jogged with the kids, and I also... work with the sewing committee, and we have full reign of the school for a month of the year. Certainly, if there was something going on in the last, 6 years, I would have seen it.
Lisa Burgess is mother of a child at Boston's Higashi School for Autistic Children, which has recently come under fire with one case of a teacher accused of abusing a child. Lisa, thanks so much for speaking to us about the school.
Well, thank you, Robin, for the chance.
And still to come, this weekend's Worldwide Music Festival Live 8 aims to raise awareness about poverty in the developing world, and along the way, they also got Pink Floyd to reunite. We'll hear some of the music of Live 8. You're listening to Here and Now. Twenty years ago, I was lucky enough to find myself narrating the biggest rock and roll benefit concert in the world. It's true, we'll make a better day.
Hello, I'm Robin Young with Tommy Hedges and Jeff Pollock with our continuing coverage, ABC's exclusive coverage of the Live Aid concerts for World Hunger.
We have just had superstar after superstar. You're talking about Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young getting together. How about the Who?
Yep, along with my friend and colleague Tommy Hedges of the Pollock Media Group, I was one of the hosts of ABC Radio's international 48-hour broadcast of Live Aid, the Uber concert to raise money to battle Africa's famine. Well, this Saturday comes a follow-up of sorts, Live 8. Bob Geldof, the creator of both Live Aid and Live 8, says instead of raising money, the goal this time is to raise awareness of starvation in Africa, to pressure the leaders of the world's wealthiest nations in advance of the Group of Eight meeting in Scotland July 6th through 8th, to increase aid to impoverished nations. I'll be listening on the sidelines, but Tommy Hedges and Pollock Media will be producing the entire worldwide radio coverage. And Tommy joins us on the line from, if it's Friday, it must be Johannesburg.
I guess so, Robin.
Hi, Tommy.
How are you?
I'm fine. I'm not sure if I should congratulate or commiserate. Live Aid was fun for the first, 30 hours. But now you've got this long broadcast. Tell us, where are the concerts this year?
Well, unlike 20 years ago, we haven't got just two stages. We've got a whole lot more. The original five stages, which will be in London, Paris, Rome, Berlin, and Philadelphia, have now been joined by additional stages in Tokyo, Toronto, Johannesburg, and Moscow.
And Scotland.
Yes, you're right. Indeed, there's more. There's more.
Well, and so how wide is the coverage? I mean, are there going to be radio stations pretty much around the world?
Yes, well over 100 radio networks. We just got confirmation that will be carried in China on the radio, which adds another 1.3 billion potential listeners there.
Amazing.
And we've also got some satellite radio coverage as well. So it's going to be quite exciting.
And I'm sure quite complex. I mean, what are some of the issues? I'm thinking time zones, first of all. Many of them are going to overlap.
Yes, that's going to be one of the major challenges at the BBC in London, where the whole thing is being put together. With the simultaneous feeds coming in from the concert venues, although Tokyo will be the first one, and that'll precede everything, there'll be a fairly large amount of time where the active stages will be happening simultaneously. So there's going to have to be some choices made in terms of who goes live, who gets recorded, and who ends up in the world feed. There's also going to be a delayed video feed in the U.S. that ABC will be carrying in prime time, which will be a much more compact event. So all in all, it's going to be a matter of trying to work out the logistics of how to have the world benefit from this amazing concert performances from such a wide variety of acts.
Tommy Hedges of the California-based Pollock Media Group is talking to us from Johannesburg, South Africa. He's been hopscotching the globe, helping to set up the radio coverage of this weekend's Live 8. And as you know, Tommy, the goal of Live 8 is to raise awareness. And I know that Bono of U2 cares passionately about debt forgiveness, for instance. But do you get the sense that other performers really do care about fair trade or an increase in aid?
Well, look, when Bob Geldof announced that he wanted to try this thing all over again, I think he really touched a nerve that many people recognized as making this a very valuable cause. All of the concert events are free. They're not looking to raise money, unlike Live Aid. They just want to get people involved. They want them to participate and put their name down so that members of the G8 summit will be able to get a little bit of an extra push to do everything they can to eliminate poverty as much as it can possibly be done, and also to reduce third world debt as much as it can be done.
Bob Geldof has also said to the performers, no bashing of President Bush. President Bush is being asked by Britain's Tony Blair to increase aid to Africa.
It's interesting that Bob, by the way, that Bob Geldof has been very careful to make it clear that he feels that, in fact, the president has been one of the people actually quite helpful in reducing the amount of debt.
Tommy Hedges of the California-based Pollock Media Group speaking to us from Johannesburg, where they're producing the international radio coverage of this weekend's Live 8 concert. Tommy, stay right there. When we come back, I'm looking at the list of performers. It's amazing to see, Lauryn Hill next to Veersind Helden. I don't even know who that is. We're going to find out from you when we come back the music of Live 8, including Pink Floyd. When we come back, you're listening to Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And tomorrow, 8 cities will host Live 8, benefit concerts that organizer Bob Geldof hopes will raise public consciousness about global poverty. Tommy Hadges of the California-based Pollock Media co-hosted Live Aid for ABC Radio with me 20 years ago. And this year, he's producing the entire worldwide radio coverage of Live 8. He's got a ringside seat on the music we're going to hear. So Tommy joins us from Johannesburg to give us a preview. And Tommy, I'm looking at the list of performers. You know, Annie Lennox to The Who and Will Smith and Lauryn Hill. It's such a broad spectrum.
There's an amazing diversity of talent. It'll be very exciting for people to hear ones that they're familiar with. There's also a lot of bands that, quite frankly, have been huge overseas. I've always been amazed at some of these bands, like Texas, for example, that's just a fabulous band from Scotland that has never really made it much in the U.S.
Let's listen to Texas, I Don't Want a Lover. Now, Tommy Hadges in Johannesburg telling us about Live 8. Why don't U.S. listeners know more about Robbie Williams?
I just can't explain it. Every time I hear one of his songs, I think that they're just the epitome of pop. Wonderful, wonderful singer. And just for some reason, has never cracked the U.S. market.
I'll contemplate and thinking about thinking. It's overrated, just get another drink and watch me come undone. There's
That's Robbie Williams. And one last band from you, Tommy Hadges, that you want us to listen to, Stereophonics.
Yeah, they had a big song about 4 years ago called Have a Nice Day. Once again, just a great band, great vocalizers, and I could not explain to you why this wasn't a hit in the U.S.
You take a holiday, is this what you want?
That's the Stereophonics. They're going to be playing at Live 8 along with, well, it sounds like just about everybody in the world. We've been talking to Tommy Hadges of Pollock Media. He's going to be organizing the worldwide radio coverage of Live 8. He's in Johannesburg. Tommy, thanks for taking some time to talk to us.
It's been a pleasure, Robin, and I hope that everyone's looking forward to listening to the event. For me, when Pink Floyd hits the stage after so many years of not having performed together, everyone's going to stop and just want to see what three or four songs they're coming up with, because this is obviously the biggest rock band in history.
We don't need no education.
Well, funny you should mention. Pink Floyd is reuniting for Live 8, and Here and Now's pop music critic Tim Riley is here to tell us more. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Robin.
So, first of all, what's the importance of the reunion? I mean, who's going to be there? What makes it such a big deal?
Well, you know, 20 years ago, Geldof pulled off this big Led Zeppelin reunion, and Phil Collins played drums to fill in for John Bonham, who had died. So that was a big... You want to have a big reunion of a superstar group here at one of these big Live Aid things, right? Mm-hmm. So Pink Floyd has agreed to reunite. Now, what that means is that Roger Waters and David Gilmour are going to share a stage as Pink Floyd, both Pink Floyd members at the same time, and that's going to be a major reconciliation between people who've been feuding for over a decade.
And so they're going to get back together for the concert and remind those who, you know, maybe just were looking the other way, how big was Pink Floyd in the 60s?
Well, they have a very interesting past because they do come out of an R&B tradition in London. They're actually named after a couple blues figures, but they catch on to the psychedelic wave and they record their debut album Down the Hall from the Beatles as the Beatles are recording Sgt. Pepper. And so Piper at the Gates of Dawn is this very renowned psychedelic record. Unfortunately, Syd Barrett, he's one of these tragic demise guys. He takes a little too much acid, and he's probably not all that mentally stable to begin with, and he's one of the great 60s casualties. We call him an acid casualty. So they have to relieve Syd Barrett of his duties, even though he is their chief songwriter. So at that point, they split, and Pink Floyd becomes something else, and they go on to become a huge group in the 70s. that is widely known for combining the psychedelic temperament with the technical sophistication of, you know, some really great sound effects. And they're one of the key movers in this movement that is about less about hit singles and more about an album that has a beginning and a middle and an end. They produce concept albums.
How I wish you were here. We're just two lost souls swimming in a fishbowl, year after year.
It's a big sound, shall we say.
It's a very pretentious sound.
Some would say pretentious.
It's very pretentious. That was part of the whole ethic. Now, purists say when they lost Syd Barrett, and I agree with this point of view, they lost a lot of the whimsy, a lot of the humor, and a lot of the complexity that went along with that early psychedelic sound that made it very compelling and very intriguing, even though it was clearly, he was just finding his legs as a songwriter. He was just starting out. But when they lost Syd Barrett, there is very little humor to be found on any of their records. And so it's a very sort of studious affair.
Listening to the music of Pink Floyd with our pop rock critic Tim Riley. Pink Floyd going to be reuniting in London for Live 8. Tim, so in the last decade or so, the members of the band might have been feuding, but they got picked up again, a whole new life with a whole new generation, discovering them through Jack Black's School of Rock movie, and there's
right.
even a country version of Pink Floyd.
Right. Well, here's where I play the grumpy old critic. You know, it's kids these days. They have no sense of humor. I mean, they're embracing this sort of superficial aesthetic. It's very clean. It's very technically accomplished. But it's really just not very substantive.
What?
You know, it's fine. They put on a great show, and it's a very theatrical. It's just not all that meaningful.
Well, it'll be to the many fans. I mean, I know you've been online. Look at all the websites devoted to the discussion of, you know, will Roger Waters be there? What will happen when they stand on stage together?
Yeah. Well, clearly, sparks are going to fly because these two people, they really do not enjoy one another, but they decided to get together for this. Well, I think the wittiest thing that Pink Floyd could do, with all the talk about G8 and raising funds for people who need money and eliminating poverty, if Pink Floyd walked out on stage and played Money, that would be the wittiest thing they could possibly do. And Money is one of the key reasons they're going to get an asterisk in the great rock encyclopedia in the sky, because Money is one of the few pop songs with an irregular meter. It's in 7/4. So here's my joke. This is Lawrence Welk counting off Pink Floyd's Money. And a 5, and a 6, and a 7.
Well, Tim Riley, hopefully Pink Floyd demonstrates that rock artists think that there is something bigger than themselves, which is a cause like Live 8. They'll be reuniting this weekend. Tim, thanks so much.
Thanks, Robin.
Money, the getaway, the get a good job with more pay and you're okay. Money.
Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. As always, we welcome your thoughts on, well, Tim Riley's thoughts on Pink Floyd or anything on our program. Send us an email at letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. I'm Robin Young. Have a great weekend and join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.